Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens on an Army base when its heart and soul, its fighting men and women, ship off to fight in the world's most dangerous places? Writer Siobhan Fallon grew up almost next door to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, but her understanding of the fears, strengths, and sacrifices of military families took on a new and intimate dimension during her years at Fort Hood, where she lived when her husband was deployed twice to Iraq. Her debut novel, written as a collection of short stories about fictional families at the real Texas base, is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. We're delighted to have her here to talk about it today. Siobhan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
What's so fascinating about this book is that it gets at the reality of so many thousands of families who are desperate to be back together and inevitably find when they are reunited that things are not the same. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's a really good point, and I don't think people think about it too often as the expectations that we all have of our perfect reunion, and then when our soldier returns, there's always a little bit of a readjustment and reassessment of the situation.
And I guess a post like Fort Hood is entirely different when those in uniform are shipped overseas. Can you talk about that?
Well, Fort Hood is just so massive. As you mentioned, I was raised outside of West Point, which is kind of a smaller, very pretty base. And then you have a real working base like Fort Hood, where soldiers are right now being deployed every other year. And there are 40,000 soldiers that work on Fort Hood, and all of the communities, you know, within the radius are either inhabited by soldiers and their families or civilians who work on post. So when you're at Hood, you feel like you are in, you know, on a military post, and you're always aware of what's going on overseas.
And then, you know, I guess businesses are not as crowded. There's even the pace of day-to-day life is different when a large group of soldiers has been deployed.
Yeah, there's a sort of a strange quietness kind of settles, and a lot of billboards suddenly go up with, you know, best of luck, first cav, or come home soon. And like you said, there's the lines to get into that front gate at Fort Hood are suddenly gone, and the Burger Kings and the shops around it, you know, it's quiet, and you know immediately, and you notice that there are a lot more families and wives because so many of the men are suddenly just not there.
Is it the situation, of course we know there are women in the U.S. military who get deployed overseas, but are there husbands who remain behind in a different sort of category than the wives who would remain?
Yes, definitely. For my particular collection of short stories, I was writing about the infantry, and right now infantry in the United States Army is still, you know, manned by men. So that was kind of my experience at Fort Hood. I was a spouse, a female, and most of the spouses I interacted with were also females, but of course there are a lot of female soldiers. And it seems to me that their husbands are often soldiers too, though. So while they're definitely civilian male spouses, I didn't know as many when I was at Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm. So in the very first story, you remind us about, first of all, how little privacy there is in most housing on a military base, which people may not be aware of. It's not just like living in an apartment. The walls are thinner. The quarters are closer. And so you have this character, Meg, who cannot help but be obsessed with what she starts to see and hear next door.
Yeah, it's kind of a running joke, and that we don't really laugh in a nice way, but more like, ha-ha, that the walls are horribly thin. And it's a notorious problem with Army housing. So it's something I've heard about always and even witnessed a few times, unfortunately. But in that story, Meg, she is definitely overly curious about Natalia's life, and that's her neighbor. And both of their husbands are deployed. So instead of Meg worrying about what her soldier is doing over in Iraq, she kind of wants to obsess about Natalia's life and imagine what's going on, and that it's so much more exciting than her own life to avoid worrying about her husband.
The story also calls up a really interesting sort of social pattern that happens, though, that Meg, on the one hand, has this almost salacious level of curiosity about Natalia. On the other hand, she sort of defends her from the gossip mill and the rumor mill, which is not kind or welcoming to Natalia.
Yeah, well, Natalia had come to the United States as a war bride, or her soldier had been deployed to Bosnia and brought her back. So the other spouses in the story are sort of mesmerized and very afraid of Natalia and the threat that she seems to represent as the unknown things that could be going on with their deployed soldiers. So they do keep her at arm's length. And Natalia is also resists the efforts that they make to like become that very fast and quick community that spouses have a tendency to form when their soldiers go. So there's some, you know, push and pull there between Natalia and the spouse network that's there.
Do you find yourself, I mean, do military wives find themselves becoming friends with people that in other circumstances they probably wouldn't associate with?
Maybe it's a little like high school. Mm-hmm. You're, I don't know, I went to a very small high school, so you become friends with the people you sit next to in class, and maybe they wouldn't be, you know, the perfect fit otherwise, but you have so many of the same experiences as an Army spouse, and it's almost easier to become friends with the woman who is going through the same thing you're going through than what might have been, you know, a perfect match in the outside world. So yeah, I think you make fast relationships and you make them quick and they become great friendships, and they might be surprising.
Also in that story, we see a theme that is repeated in several places throughout the book, which is the ambivalence that women in particular have, young women, about when and whether to have children when their husbands are almost guaranteed to be away for several years of their children's early lives.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a conversation I certainly had with my soldier husband, and a lot of my friends did too, of balancing the, on the one hand, you might have more free time in a way when, you know, and you want something to keep you busy. I know that seems like a harsh way to look at a child, but you're in a new place and you probably can't work outside of the home just because you're picking up and traveling so often as a military spouse. So some people think, like, now's the time to have a child. But then, again, you're alone and in a new place without your family and without your mate. So, it's a lot to think about and plan for.
The second story in the book actually takes place in Iraq, centered around this soldier named David. Is it Mogensen? Is that how you're...
Yes,
Mogensen? Okay. And he's struggling with the idea that his army self, this guy that is known as Moog and has a certain amount of power and has learned how to do things, is starting to become more of who he really is than this guy David, who has parents and a fiance and friends from college. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. I sort of would see that kind of transformation in some soldiers, which was fascinating. Like, the more often they would return from a deployment, the more they seemed to become this idea of a soldier. And they didn't always resist it. You know, they would talk about certain missions, and there was definitely this level of excitement in their voice that they might not be talking about, I don't know, investment banking or other things. But so... it was fascinating to me that when somebody would make that decision to join the Army after maybe, you know, imagining a completely different life for themselves, and then suddenly they enlist at a time like September 11th, how they might find that it fits their life more than they could have ever imagined. But there's still always that desire to return to the original life and what the rest of society sees as a successful life. So I think a lot of guys and, you know, women soldiers sort of juggle that issue of how long they're going to be in when it hadn't been the original, you know, a choice for their entire lifetime.
In that story also, we touch on the idea of having a female interpreter, and they call them sort of a shorthand, they call them TERPs. And I really liked it because it looks at what women are able to do in jobs that are traditionally thought of as male jobs. Can you talk about what caused you to decide that would be an element of this particular short story?
Well, I always wondered what the women in the Middle East, or in Iraq in particular, were doing suddenly. And I had done a lot of research for that story in particular and known that they had so much more freedom until fairly recently. And especially Saddam Hussein had really wanted women behind him when his rise to power and had given them an incredible amount of, incredible for, you know, the Middle East, of job options and schooling. And then when he did become powerful, he suddenly took it all back. So I was just wondering what these women who had such a high level of education and great English and maybe studied abroad, what they were suddenly, you know, left with in this country that was in the midst of a war and they suddenly didn't have as many options. And interpreters in general, there's so many amazing stories that I don't think we hear enough about how they're constantly putting their lives on the line to try and bring their country forward and to work with the Americans. And a lot of soldiers have made really incredible have friendships that continue. You know, and once they return to the States, they can email and they want to bring their TERPs to the United States. So I love that idea and wanted to put as much of their plight into that particular story. So, yeah, there's so much more I wish I could have told because my husband has so many interpreters that he's worked with in the past that he just admires, and they'd be really great assets here in America.
What was your research process like? I mean, obviously you talked to your husband, you talked to your friends, but what sort of, like, you know, did you go to the library as well? What did you do to make sure you understood these stories you wanted to tell?
I've been writing for a long time, and I spent quite a while bartending at my father's Irish pub, and I kind of pride myself on being a good listener. So I think that kind of, a little bit like Meg in that first story, like the desire to hear people's stories and wonder what's going on beyond the words, translates well to right now as, you know, a soldier's wife and going to a lot of Army functions. And when you get a bunch of soldiers together, they love to swap their stories. Mm-hmm. And they're crazy deployment stories. So I love to hear them and would listen and try and pick up details that were different and kind of make some notes and do a little research and let my mind kind of piece it all together.
What I loved here is that you're the narrator in the stories, but you don't seem to be uncomfortable with not knowing exactly every detail and how things turn out in some cases.
Yeah, I feel like that's how life is. It's so hard to know, even with your own spouse that you think you know everything about them. There are things you will never know, no matter how hard you try. So I feel that way in life, and I wanted to have that in my fiction as well, that there's an unknowable part of, you know, every single day and every person. And so, yeah, I hope it didn't bother you, Chris.
No, I actually really liked it because it let me keep thinking. My guest is novelist Siobhan Fallon. Her new book is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. If you'd like to join our conversation now, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Siobhan Fallon. Her new book is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I have to tell you, Siobhan, I loved all the stories. I think my very favorite and the one that I keep turning over in my head because it works on so many different levels is the third one called Remission. And to set that up, essentially, it's this woman, Ellen, and she's been dealing with cancer. And so her husband, unlike most of her friends' husbands, did not go overseas. He's remained behind. But that alone, more than the cancer, sort of separates her from her friends.
Yeah. Kind of that new kind of normal that exists, especially in a place like Fort Hood, when because everyone's soldiers are deploying, you know, home a year, deploy a year, home a year, deploy a year. It's kind of what people know and are almost most comfortable with. So when somebody isn't sharing that experience, whether it was her friends or her own, you know, idea of it, is she thinks that she's becoming an outcast.
And in some ways, her husband isn't there because he's exceptionally busy and really wrapped up in trying to take care from thousands of miles away of these guys he's responsible for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are Rear D Commander, my husband's most recent deployment. My husband would joke from Iraq that he had, our Rear D Commander, who was dealing with the spouses, had more work to do than my husband did while he was deployed, and that the guy who was home was probably always wishing he was in Iraq because, you know, that mission is more black and white. It's what they've been trained to do, whereas the Rear D Commander is suddenly dealing with the needs of the families who are home and kind of the getting the food to the soldiers or the arms and, you know, getting things fixed and sending them overseas. But he's missing out on what some people could see as like the big game or, you know, what they've been training for so long.
The story also plays in an unusual way with the fears that children of soldiers have about potentially losing a parent. In this case, the parent whose life is most at risk is Ellen, the mother.
Right. I think that is something that the children of soldiers have to, you know, deal with one way or another, either consciously or not, and something parents don't want to talk about with their kids, but sort of inevitably comes up of the things that could happen when you have a soldier gone for a long period of time. And that's kind of why I wanted it to actually be Ellen, who the mom, who's not a soldier, to be the biggest fear that this daughter has, is, you know, of losing her mother, not the soldier father that you'd expect as a reader.
I know that you have a daughter, is that right?
I do, and she's 3.
Okay, so she's still quite young. But is it your sense from watching other families that the parents are trying to protect the kids by not talking very openly about this, and the kids are doing the same thing for their parents?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you always want to paint the best picture. So parents would, of course, not want their children to worry, and I guess they're probably avoiding the things that the kids probably want to talk about. And kids wanting at the same time to not have their parents worry about them. So, wow, I'll have to remember that.
How, in multiple scenes in the book, you have women getting together to sort of take care of one another, but also to think about what they can do to comfort their soldiers from afar, and they're sending over care packages, and they're raising money, and is that about, you think, a sense of maintaining some control over a situation that from you know, the home base in Fort Hood, Texas, is really completely out of their control?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as a spouse, that was the only way I could take care of my soldier, was putting together those care packages or doing the small things that would get to him or maybe make his job easier if I was sending donations to the school that he was, you know, trying to get books for their library, or an orphanage he worked with once, so everybody was sending clothes and toys for the children there. So, yeah, it's very easy to focus on those things that you can do at home and almost get too wrapped up in them. Like, I if I missed the post office one day, I mean, it's so silly, but I would get so upset that I didn't mail the package on the day I needed to mail it, and mm-hmm. oh my gosh, and you get yourself all worked up about things that really don't matter, but that's, like you said, the only control you have over your soldier, so it becomes tremendous.
Do you feel guilty, not you specifically, but do the wives and families feel guilty in a way that they're living in relative comfort in the United States while the person they love the most is off in this dangerous war?
I think so. And it makes it a little harder for communication because
yeah.
it's hard to, you know, talk about your kids' birthday parties or wonderful things that are happening at home when you know that your soldier is, I don't know, eating cold food out of a bag again or using baby wipes because there's no running water and all of the other things he's dealing with. So, I mean, I would remember starting to tell a story about my daughter and then I'd say, oh, gosh, but, you know, that doesn't matter. Tell me what you're doing. You know, I want to know about you. And he would say, I want to hear the details, the ordinary small stuff. I need to think about that or that's more important than you realize. Hmm. So it all boils down to like trying to keep communication as in every way you can. And I don't know.
And I know it's better now than it used to be. There's Skype and there's email and things like that, which are not ideal and maybe not every single day, but in this book, I think it's fascinating. Multiple times, volumes are spoken by whether or not a call is made right at the very first second it can be made or how long that call lasts. Is there a tendency, do you think, to sort of overanalyze what those calls might mean? And we'll get to the worries about infidelity and things like that in a moment. But is that something that you do? Do you go over it again and again in your head?
Yeah, it's kind of the double-edged sword of suddenly having a little bit more freedom with technology mm-hmm. because the people who are lucky enough to be able to call home, say, every day, when they don't call, of course the spouse is immediately assuming something must have happened.
Yeah.
Instead of just that, you know, her soldier got to the chow hall late and, you know, there was hot food, so he's hanging out there longer. You never know. And it can do both. But I think it's all very specific to the different forward operation bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, because even in 2009, when my husband was there, he still didn't really have regular access to email. And then I had friends whose soldiers were able to Skype every day. So it really depends. And I've heard, you know, the pros and cons of each. Like the wives who almost rather not have that constant call because then they weren't worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had the letters that you can handle the letter. You can read it when you have a quiet moment. You're ready for it versus the call that might mess up your whole day if you're shopping and you miss it and so you're upset. So it's so different for everybody.
Let's talk about this issue of infidelity. It seems
okay.
Here in many of these families, almost the thing that they fear almost as much as the death of their loved one is infidelity.
I think that's a very almost, I don't want to say easy concern to have, but it's something you can think about that is not as horrific as, you know, a bodily harm that might happen to your soldier. So back to not knowing what's going on day in, day out. Like we, as a society, we read Anna Karenina, or like we know how infidelity plays out in a normal situation. So it's almost just the fallback fear that I think you can have and handle emotionally rather than the worst that could happen. But I've been asked if I think infidelity occurs more often in the Army than anywhere else in the world, and I think it's just a smaller place. Everyone knows sort of each other's business, whether they want to or not. So if it happens, people hear about it in a way that you might not hear about everywhere else.
Hmm. And in one story in the book, a character makes a choice to sort of, she discovers something that she wasn't expecting. and ultimately makes a choice to, well, this is another one where you sort of leave it open, but it looks like maybe she's going to move on from this.
Yeah, Kailani, the character in that story, she doesn't think she's somebody who would take a situation like that, but when she's aware of the possibility that her husband may have cheated, she thinks of all the different options. She might contact the commander's wife to find out if this particular woman soldier that she thinks, you know, has been part of this little tango, to find out if it's true. And there's just so many implications in every direction she wants to go. If she contacts the battalion commander's wife, then the wife will probably tell the battalion commander, who will have to do the official side of things in the army and talk to the sergeants and talk to the soldier to see if indeed adultery occurred. So she's a little worried about her husband's career and everyone else finding out. But most of all, when her husband does return, she wants that fresh start and realizes he's seen and done some things that he will never tell her while he was deployed, and she's not sure if she can handle knowing all of the details of what happened for that year he was away. And he decides the best thing for their marriage and their children and herself is just to start fresh from this day on. They will have a new life together.
It would seem that that alone, that reality of knowing that there is something hugely important to the person you love most in the world that you may not ever fully share or be able to fully comprehend. I mean, that would be hard in any situation, particularly in this country where, right or wrong, we sort of have convinced ourselves that marriage is about constant honesty all the time.
Right.
I mean, talk about how the different ways that people find to cope with the fact that there are things they'll never understand about their partner.
Well, I'm someone who kind of thinks it happens, even if your partner's with you every day. Like, you can never climb into somebody else's head. But
yeah,
when you have a deployment situation, I mean, it's the extreme because you, 12 to 15 months of your lives are spent apart. So there's just no way to share all of those missed experiences. I mean, who knows what really were the most important experiences of those 12 months to tell your spouse when you're back together again, and what changed you in ways that you're not even aware of. So I don't know. I think you probably try. You want to catch each other up when you're back, but it's in the past. You know, so much has happened and so much is happening as soon as you get back, and new moments and children changing and growing, and life goes on.
Siobhan Fallon is my guest. Her new book is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Mazin in Dallas. Hi, Mazin.
Hi, yes. I'm an Iraqi American. I've been came from Iraq around 1991. I just want to comment on the last, I think, the answer or the comment that your guest gave. I wasn't listening from the beginning, but I just kind of caught the end of the last discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So just want to clarify maybe a misconception about the role of women in Iraqi society.
Please.
And I was in Iraq back in September, first time I've been there since leaving in 1991. I didn't really see any significant change in the role of women in society. You know, they're just going about their business, doing the same things that they were doing before. You know, my sister-in-law, who's a doctor, got up and went to work every morning. My niece, who is a lecturer in the university, did the same. And you know, things are not much different than what they were from a societal perspective when Saddam Hussein was in power. The other thing I want to point out is that I think the misconception that, you know, to give credit to Saddam Hussein about everything that ever was, you know, positive in Iraq, like exaggerating his impact on the lot of women. Really, Iraqi women were well-educated before Saddam Hussein came into power, and they continue to be so today. So that was just my comment I wanted to make.
Thanks for calling. Did you want to respond to that, Siobhan?
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's fabulous news. I wish we had more stories about, you know, the current role of women in Iraq. I think that's great. Thank you so much, Mazin, for calling in.
How do husbands cope with the potential that their wives might be unfaithful? Is it something that they, to your understanding, they don't even talk to their buddies about? I mean, men and women communicate with their friends in different ways, but...
How do the soldiers, you mean, in, who are serving in Iraq? How
yeah, they... and I want to get to the story about that's called Leave, sort of coming out of this question.
Well, it seems to be a pretty constant fear of soldiers. I mean, they're not home, obviously, doing the things that they would want to be doing for their spouses. I mean, just the ordinary things of taking out the trash and putting the kids to bed. So I think they are worried they're going to be replaced. I mean, they're gone a long time, and they know their families are under a lot of stress. And I imagine, and I've heard, that is, of course, something they would worry about, that somebody might be there who can do the things that they just, it's impossible for them to do because they are so far away. So they might, you know, let themselves think about infidelity probably much more than they should.
And so you have this character who essentially gets, I'm going to set this up and then we're going to take a break and we can talk a little bit more about it. He gets a 2-week leave and doesn't tell his wife and daughter and comes home and is going to hide out sort of in the basement to find out if his suspicions are true. We'll talk a little bit more about that story by Siobhan Fallon. Her new collection of stories written as a novel is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. We'll resume our conversation with Siobhan in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is debut novelist Siobhan Fallon. Her new book is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Siobhan, in the story Leave, you have this chief warrant officer named Nick Cash, and he suspects that his wife might be having an affair based on some information that he got. So he goes home without telling his family and breaks into his own family's basement to sort of observe. Now, regardless of what happens, we get the sense from the beginning, this really uneasy sense that whatever he's experienced has sort of damaged him psychologically, that he's gone, that this is the best way that he has to handle his suspicions. Can you talk a little bit about what you thought about as you crafted the character and the story and what would take place in that story?
Sure. Chief Warrant Officer Nick Cash is incredibly good at his job in Iraq, and he's a military intelligence officer and is always sifting through the different stories he's getting and, you know, trying to find that objective, the arms or the person who might be double dealing, you know, and he's great. And then when he has to come back to the United States, he can't shut that off. So in Iraq, he's the sanest person, you know, in a pretty insane place, but it doesn't translate well to the home front. And when he has these suspicions, he immediately handles the suspicions in the way he would as a soldier rather than as a husband and a father. So it's kind of my take on a very extreme situation that rather than, you know, have a conversation with your wife or just try and fit yourself back into her life, he burrows himself into the basement with his gear and his, you know, his MREs, and he listens and, you know, is doing his own method of surveillance.
Yeah, what's so, you know, heartbreaking about that story is that it's clear before you know the outcome of the story that he's already lost a great deal of what his former life used to be.
Right.
How strong is the worry of mental injury as compared with physical injury among the wives and families who are waiting for their husbands to come home?
It seems like something that people are just starting to talk about. I mean, the most obvious fear is an physical injury.
Mm-hmm.
And I think only with these constant deployments are people noticing that, you know, there's maybe some psychological things that need to be talked about. And the Army, I have to say, has really stepped up their reintegration programs with soldiers and have them do a lot of surveys, and they have the spouses attend reintegration meetings before their soldiers come home so that we know what to look for if something has gone awry with our soldier and how they're handling their return to the States. So we're definitely talking about it a lot more in the military community and trying to heighten awareness and get the information out to spouses and soldiers about how they could get help.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Kenneth in Dallas. Hi, Kenneth.
Yes, hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mrs. Fallon, I'm sorry, I only came into your at this program midway. I have a question for you following up on Chris's question about mental health and specifically the shocking case in Tampa with the full colonel assigned to the Central Command was in Qatar when his wife killed their two teenage children. Questions about the support level, networking between enlisted men, junior officers and senior officers. Does an officer specifically hurt his career by being deployed if he suspects that his wife may be mentally ill, and if he asked to be stay behind while she obtains treatment? I'll go off the air to take your response. And, Chris, please follow up on this. I think this is an important question.
Well, thanks for your call, Kenneth. And I will, before Siobhan answers, I will say she's not a spokesperson for the Army, so we're not going to put her in that position. But if you want to respond to what your sense is of that, I'd be interested in the answer, Siobhan.
So basically whether I think it would hurt somebody's career if they chose to stay home rather than deploy to care for a spouse who's maybe mentally having some problems. But, Kenneth's question?
Yeah.
I think they would realize that, you know, the soldier is doing what they need to do for their to keep their family intact. And, of course, there is this sense of, like, go, 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 you know, be the best at your job. And a lot of that is, you know, performing well in a deployment situation and leading the troops. So I know what you're saying, Kenneth. And I think, though, that the modern Army is much more aware. And when my husband was a company commander, one of his soldiers in Iraq was having problems with his spouse at home, he would do everything in his power to send that soldier home to try and, if it was a physical illness or if it was something else, he would try and get that soldier home to try and work on the problem. And then my role back at Fort Hood, working with the family readiness group, would be to, you know, make sure I had whatever counselors or chaplains or whatever I could do on my side to get that to the spouse as well. So the Army definitely, it's a little different than the old Army that we all think of with if the Army wanted you to have a family, they'd issue you one. Now they realize that for the soldier to perform well while they're deployed, they can't worry about the people at home that depend on them. So it's difficult, but they, when they can, they are really trying to put family first.
You just mentioned the fact that your husband was company commander, then you said, and my role, you know, back at Fort Hood. It's very interesting. People may not be aware that there is a whole legion of military wives, of soldiers, who have these sort of unofficial, unpaid jobs that are taken very seriously in terms of caring for one another and also for trying to sort of, from a distance, care for their soldiers.
Yeah, it's going to sound silly, but when my husband and I were just dating, he sort of laid it out and said, I would expect my spouse to be very active in, you know, in the Army, and I would really want her to be a family readiness group leader if that time ever comes. And I remember thinking about it and saying, yeah, I would like to be, you know, part of your life in that way. So I know it was very important to him immediately that he always knew he wanted a spouse who would be active in working with other spouses. So it plays a big role. And I mean, depending on the chain of command, each unit is different, but they really try and give the FRG as much support as they can. And they want those spouses to have each other to lean on. And so we try and do a lot of meetings and fundraisers and just social events so that when you don't have your mate there day in, day out, there's somebody you can call if you need them. And I've driven women to the emergency room and, you know, brought food to families who had somebody in the hospital. And all of us did. We really tried to do what we could to soften, you know, that absence.
Did your role as an FRG leader make you more conscientious than you might even otherwise have been about making sure that anybody in this book was so different from a real human being that there could be no confusion about the fact that this is a work of fiction?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want anyone to read a character and think that I had, you know, lifted their life and, you know, stolen it and written it down, because I'd be crushed if I read a book and found myself in it without anyone, you know, asking me. So yeah, it taught me a lot of sensitivity, and it also kind of went hand in hand with my writing this book and trying to think about the lives of different people. Instead of kind of feeling sorry for myself, oh, my husband's deployed, I have a baby, poor me, who's going to take out the trash this morning, you know, and I had to think about people who had less of a support system than I did and other hardships that families, like my neighbors, might be going through. So being an FRG leader had a great impact on my life, and I think it helped my writing a lot.
How do you, military spouses, when they're in those times between deployments, I mean, is there like a point, I would think maybe when someone first gets back, it's like a honeymoon, and then all of a sudden things are really weird, and then before they're about to deploy again, is there a period at which you think, well, he's deploying in a week. We can't have a big blowout fight because I don't want us to be in a fight when he leaves. Is there an element of that?
Oh, yeah. And even, I don't know, I feel like almost 6 months of that year he's back, you're thinking, oh, he just got back. I can't tell him to pick up his dirty laundry. Or
yeah, yeah.
And again, as the month's winding down till he's getting ready to go again. It definitely stops you maybe from doing things you do in a normal situation, which is one of the strange stressors that you kind of have to negotiate in your relationship, because you don't want it to build up, that either a resentment or the fact that you can't yell at him at something that, or not yell, you might not have the conversations that you would want to in a day-in, day-out relationship. So
yeah,
I think it, just knowing that and saying, wow, I should tell him. Regardless, I need to be honest with him and myself, whether he's going or not. And knowing your soldier would want you to, he doesn't want you to keep these things from him, however small.
Is it your sense that a career military marriage is just a different organism than a different kind of marriage in the civilian world?
I think it depends on the couple.
Uh-huh.
You. Well, I mean, it's the only marriage I've known.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm not 100% sure, but...
I will say there's things that you have to deal with that sound really different from, you know, the toughest days in a civilian marriage, which is the only kind that I know.
Right. I don't know. I need to think about that. I'm not sure.
What have you heard from people who have read this book and say, you've told a story that I completely relate to? Is it all military wives, or is it other people that surprise you?
I've been getting a lot of emails, and I'd almost say 50-50. Like, I've heard from people who say, wow, I never would have picked up this book, but I liked the cover, and I really enjoyed it, and thank you for letting me, you know, have a glimpse into this world that I didn't know anything about.
Yeah.
And then I've heard a lot from military families or the children of people who've served in Vietnam or Korea, and who said, you know, it was refreshing to see, you know, some of my experience in a collection of short stories. So I've gotten a lot of really great feedback from both civilians and military.
Did you have your husband reading what you were writing all along, or did you want it to be finished before you handed it off to him?
Oh, he read it from the first moment. He's been my, I don't know, my first reader and everything, and he's fabulous. And he was an English major at West Point, so he, you know, he had a little bit of the right background that I needed in a spouse too. But he's a soldier, so he was a tremendous help, especially with the two stories that from a male point of view, and when I needed details about Iraq, and of course I haven't been there, and he would read them and give me advice, or there was a time where he was emailing friends who were deployed and saying, tell me what the butcher shop closest to your FOB looks like and what animal is hanging in the wind, you know, just looking for as many real details and helping me out in every way he could. So he's just been fabulous from beginning to end.
That's an amazing sort of resource to have when
you're
trying
to
do research.
Yeah, it's the silver lining, that's for sure, is that he had the experiences and he's got friends who are experiencing it right now, so a lot of people were helping me out with this.
Well, Siobhan Fallon, thank you so much for having this discussion with us. It really is an interesting glimpse into a world that I didn't know too much about, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
The new novel by Siobhan Fallon is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.